Accession number 31448, Mr. Roy Jones, Real 4. Now, we're going through the various weapons training you got. Now, you said light machine gun. Now, was that the Bren or was
Bren.
It still a Lewis?
That's the Bren gun.
Now, tell me about your training on the Bennett, on the Bren.
On the Bren. I liked the Bren gun, I did. There was a lot more to learn with a Bren gun than there was with a rifle. Your training was pretty much the same when you first started with that. You'd have an instructor alongside you. He'd tell you to load the magazine. I think it was 20 rounds, I think, if my memory serves me rightly. And he'd show you how to insert the magazine in. Then you'd cock the weapon, set your sights, and you could either fire single or automatic with the stem. Even on automatic, if you knew how to feather the trigger, you could get a single shot off on automatic with them. And the kick of a Bren gun, incidentally, and strangely enough, wasn't as bad as a rifle. I think you fired with the LMG one magazine first, just to get the gist, and you'd fire the same as your rifle. You'd fire it different, 100 yards, 200 yards, 300 yards, 500 yards, and but you went through the same thing with the LMG as you did with the rifle.
And what about the Bren gun? I mean, what did you think of it? I mean, for accuracy and.
I thought it was pretty accurate, the Bren gun. And I forget what. He had a gas jet on them. Because he used to say, fires one or two rounds and stops. And I think that meant insufficient gas.
This is stoppage procedure, yeah.
Yeah, insufficient gas. So you just turn the gas, I don't know what it was called, the gas ports or something, round to the next largest hole and carried on. But yeah, I wouldn't have liked to have been the Bren gun carrier, if you like. Because whatever route marches you were on, if you were carrying a rifle and the other fellow was carrying a Bren gun, it's probably twice the weight. So they used to sling them across the back when they carried them.
What about stripping them down and all this blindfold business? Did you actually do all that?
Yeah, they'd strip it down. And they never used to, in training, try to kid you or move any part. They might have done that later on when you were really, if you were having a competition, you know, a bit of a skylark in a competition, that do it. But the Bren had very, very few moving parts. I think you push the button, pull the butt back, and then you just took the working parts out in one, and that split into two. And that's all it was.
So when people talk about stripping them down blindfolded, it's not that much of a thing.
It's not that much of a thing, no.
Now, what about the Sten gun? Did you mention the Sten gun?
Sten.
Now, that's a very different kettle of fish.
Yeah, well, the Sten gun was a cheap and nasty weapon. Cheap and nasty. It was cheap and nasty, the Sten. And the only thing wrong with the Sten gun, I think later on they altered it, was when you put your left hand round it, you had to be very, very careful of the gas port when it kicked back. That was wide open. Well, in the later models, they put like a finger guard.
So can you just explain why? I don't think they'll understand why.
Because if you'd catch your little finger in it and the tip of your finger would go. So that's because of the working parts going backwards and forwards.
Inside the gas port.
Inside the gas port. Yeah.
So if you put your finger in it.
That was it, yeah. It'd take the top of your finger off. But then, as I say, later on they modified them and put like a finger guard on. Why the hell they didn't do that in the first place, I wouldn't know.
Were you aware that if you dropped them, they'd go off? Then? Were you trained in that? Because they would.
They would go off, yeah. And then
did you know that, though?
Yeah, they told us that. If they fell on the butt, the safety catch, the bolt would just drop and pull itself out and go off. I think they did something with the later models to stop that. Whether they did or not, I don't know. Because I didn't see much of a Sten gun after we finished our training in Northern Ireland.
What did you think of its accuracy and range?
The range wasn't very good, but the accuracy wasn't bad, that I thought. Even firing from the hip, it didn't have a big spread, put it that way. Didn't have a big spread at all.
So that's it. Now, other weapons.
Well, the Tommy gun.
That's a Thompson
machine gun, yeah.
Tell me about that one.
American. Can't remember much about this. I can never, ever remember stripping one of them down. Because never ever saw one after finished training in Northern Ireland.
What was it like to fire? Because there weren't many about.
There weren't many. I only fired one once. And there was quite a kick with them. But and the magazine held a lot more than what the Sten gun did.
Were they heavier then?
Yeah, they were heavier, yeah. Of course, they had the round magazines, and they also had the straight magazine with different models.
Was it as accurate or more accurate?
I think it was a little more accurate than what the Sten gun was. But as I say, it didn't have much to do with it. I think, as I'm looking here at what record I've got here of when I was in. I only ever fired 60 rounds.
Now, what about other weapons? Piat?
Piat, yeah.
Now, that's a funny old gun, isn't it? I mean, because it...
Yeah, that had a kick like a horse.
Was that the one that was sort of elastic powered or wound up?
How do you mean? No, with the Piat... was it loaded from the...
I think it's a spring-loaded one.
Yeah, but it wasn't... There was no wires or anything like that, like the Yankee one. I can't remember. Was it loaded from the front? Or the back? I can't remember.
All right.
Because there again, with that... I only ever fired that once.
What you said, well, let's concentrate on what you do remember. I've taken you off a bit there. What was it like to fire?
It had a kick like a mule. And although I say that, they were pretty accurate, them. But as I say, I can't say too much about that one because I only fired two practice shots. That's all.
Now, what about hand grenades?
Well, we had the 2-inch mortar as well.
Oh, yeah, let's do that first, then. 2-inch mortar.
2-inch mortar. I thought that was a great little weapon, that. And that was used an awful lot because it was very lightweight to carry.
Now, tell me, how was it operated?
It was... You could operate it yourself. You sort of placed it on the ground. You'd slide a bomb in from the top. And you just pulled a handle at the bottom. And that was it. And if you wanted it to go further, you'd just drop the trajectory that way. Instead of whatever angle you had it at, from 90 down 45 or in between. And
was it guesswork or was it technically? Was there a sight?
If I can remember rightly, they had like a sight on the right hand side of it, just above where you fired, and it was like a round. Milled knob, and I can't remember what the indentations
but you like that
were
one.
For yeah, that wasn't bad at all.
And what about the hand grenades?
Hand grenades, yes.
How do they train you on them? Because a lot of soldiers find that quite intimidating the first time with hand grenades.
Well, as I say, all I ever did while I was in was throw six. And that you do practice ones first where there's no fuse. And all you do is pull the pin, both arms outstretched. And as soon as you open your hand, there's a number of ways you can throw a grenade. You can pull the pin, stretch your arm back and throw. And
round arm.
Yeah, and the pin and the arm will just fly off and the pin drops. But you can do it a number of ways. There's a 5 second and a 7 second fuse. And I think with the 7 second fuse, what you could do was open your hand and let it go. Let the clip go so that the pin drops and just go one, two, and then throw it. So that would go when it reached off sooner than the 5 second one. Because at 5 seconds, you just let it go and throw. Where the other one, if it's 7 seconds, you could open it and go one, two, three. And what they always taught you, that the arm you place out in the front.
Your left
like
arm.
That, your left
did
arm.
You throw, did you threw right-handed, didn't you? Yeah, so.
Yeah. Well, you have to.
So you say.
No, wait a minute. No, I'm wrong. No, with a grenade, you can go that way. Yeah, you can go. What if you were right-handed, yeah. But if you happen to be left-handed, which I was then you can throw a grenade left-handed. And with the hand that you suck out in front, you put roughly in line with where you wanted it to go.
So exactly like bowling in cricket.
That's right. Exactly. Good explanation. But just like cricket, if you point your arm to where you want the grenade to go.
Were you nervous about throwing it when you got to the live one? As you said, you threw
no,
a couple of...
No, because we were in... We were behind sandbags. And you were throwing it probably 20, 30 yards, something like that. So as soon as you let it go, you were down.
The problem is if someone drops one in the trench, I think.
Well, that never, ever happened to me. But I would imagine that if somebody was unfortunate enough to open one, then what they used to say to us was the way a grenade was patterned in little squares, that was so everybody got the same share or piece. Nobody got any more than anybody else, and that's the way they used to put it to us as recruits. That's why it was made like that, so everybody would get an equal share.
Now, any other weapons?
No, that was it.
Was safety a big impact part of weapons training? Because it is in the modern army. I wonder.
Yes, it's always been the case.
So, what are the safety rules of handling weapons?
Well, the first rule you're ever taught in the service is you never point a weapon, loaded or unloaded, at anybody. Whether you think it's loaded or unloaded, you never point a weapon at anybody. And if you get that into your mind, then you'll never ever point one. I know accidents happen. I've seen it on a range where an instructor told a bloke to stop firing and stand up, and he's turned like that with his rifle in his hand and his finger on the trigger, and he's turned and accidentally pointed the rifle at the instructor, and they got a clip around the ear hole. But it wasn't done on purpose. But these are the things that they instill in you, that no matter what the circumstance, you never point a weapon.
Now, what about tactical training? This is things like fieldcraft. Start me with fieldcraft.
Well, in Northern Ireland, there was plenty of ground there to do your fieldcraft, and we were taught section and platoon attacks, where you'd do things like a right flanking movement or a left flanking movement, and you always used the hedges as cover. So, for instance, if you were in a field and the hedge was on the right-hand side, and you wanted a left flanking movement, then you would go along the hedge on the right-hand side and along the hedge at the top of the field. You didn't do out in the open the flanking movement. You did the flanking movement round the hedge where you couldn't be seen, left or right. You always camouflage your helmet with grass or leaves in the area that you're in, so that you blend with whatever is behind you and in front. You do the same with your equipment, your pack, so that none of the brass shone if it happened to be sunny. Although you never polished the brasses that much in the army during the war, that came later in peacetime, but all the brasses on the equipment mostly then were like a gunmetal thing on your equipment, or all the buckles and what have you on the straps. Fieldcraft, it was quite good fieldcraft, I used to enjoy that. The only part I didn't like about fieldcraft was digging trenches, which we had to do. And I remember one where we were taken to this field and told to dig a trench and make a good job of it. So we were digging trenches, we were put in sections of three, I think, to dig a trench. And they gave us a couple of hours, something like that, to do it. And we're all stood there, finished. They came round, inspected the trenches, and they said, right, oh, everybody in the trench with your weapons. So we got in the trench with weapons. The next thing, a tank come rolling into the field. And the instructor said, now we'll see how good your trenches are. And the tank just come in and rolled over all of them, one after the other, with us in them. That was a bit hairy, that one was, because I think that was the first time I'd ever seen a tank. And we were told to make a good job of the trench, so that you couldn't then say afterwards, well, we weren't told. We were told, but we weren't told there was a tank coming.
You weren't told why?
Why? So it was good. We did it that day, and then we had them later on, and it was fine. But the first time that ever happens to me was a bit daunting, that seeing that tank come towards you, and you're in a slit trench, which is about 18 inches wide, I think, something like that, 6 foot in length. And that roll over the top.
It was slit trenches then?
Yeah.
Anything else about field craft or tactical training?
No, not a great deal.
Now, what about preparing for kit inspections? Because, you know, that's a big part of, you know,
yeah.
You know, how would you get your kit and equipment ready for a big inspection?
Well,
and your room, actually. You know.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that bad in the army. As I say, it was wartime, and I don't think the emphasis... We had kit inspections, but that was only like a kit check, where you folded your socks up and all that, and you blankoed your equipment. And that was just like a khaki green block. How can I explain it, what it looked like? It just looked like a block of soap, but it was khaki green. And it was like a block of dye, really. And you used water on a brush to go over all your webbing equipment, which was, when it dried, was dark green. Then you had to get the blanco off the buckles and everything like that. You didn't polish them because of gunmetal. So you just made sure there was no blanco on your...
Just brushed it off.
Just with water, got that off. But the blanco was water and a brush, and that went all over your equipment so it looked nice and clean. And you did that, you cleaned your boots.
What about, how was it, spit and polish with boots, or was it just normal?
Just normal, your boots.
And what about your room? How were you meant to lay your kit out on the bed, that kind of
thing? Well, of a morning, all you done was your mattress, you folded in half. Then two of your blankets were folded up into a square, and your third blanket was folded oblong and wrapped round the two neatly, made into a box. Your equipment would hang on a hook behind your bed, and all your other equipment, clothes and stuff, was in a kit bag, which was behind your bed. That was what you had to do every morning now. But when you laid your kit out, all your equipment come out onto the bed, and the mattress would be down, your blankets would be laid on top of the bed, and you laid your equipment and your clothes on top of the bed. Your clothes were always folded in a certain way, shirts, your jumpers, socks, underwear, mess tins, knife, fork, spoon, mug, plates, all in a certain pattern on your bed. Then once that was done, the room had to be tidied. If there was lino floor, it had to be polished.
With bumpers or just...
Yeah, I can't say what they were because I'd get accused of swearing. They were something breakers.
You can say it, don't worry, we don't mind.
Right, well, we used to call them bollock breakers.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah.
It was like a big, heavy leaden thing where we used to put old blankets underneath it and spread the polish, then take that one off, put this one on and go over it till the floor was polished. Windows, all the windows cleaned, and that was about it.
So it wasn't
that bad actually in the army.
Wasn't that level of bull you'd get later. We'll come back to that, I think.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get... I mean, so anything else you might do in a typical day?
Well, you'd have your routine, a daily routine, where, like I said before, where you were up breakfast, then you wash, shave, and then whatever activity it was for that day, because it varied each day. Although you used to do probably the same things each day, but you'd do them at a different time. It wouldn't be a set time every day for PT or map reading and that's one thing I haven't mentioned is the map reading side, which I found very interesting indeed.
How did they train you in map reading then?
Well, they just give you a map and then they showed you how to a four-figure map reference. And one of the sayings we used to get, and that come from the army for me, was map reading. If you always remember, you've got to get across her before you get up her. And if you think about that, a four-figure map reference, you go across first. So if you're looking at a map, you go across the map to find the square. And then you come up the map with your second two figures. So if you can remember that each square like that, and one line there could be coming across that way, that's the line going up vertical, come across, it could be 3-5. So that's 3-5 there. And the one coming up, which is running horizontal, could be, I don't know, 2-6. So your square would be 3-5-2-6. So it's 3-5-2-6. And that is the square then. But then when you get to a six-figure map reference, it could be 3-5-2, 268. So it's 3-5. Now, if you can visualize that square quarter into 10 little squares, you count in 3-5, one, two little squares in, 2-6-3, 2-6-3. Then you count up to 2-6, and you go 1-2-3, and where the two meet, that's your map reference. And with a six-figure map reference, you can pinpoint a church, a pub, or anything spot on. So map reading was quite good, and it came in good later on in life as well, when I'd learned to drive a car, and you were going touring and one thing and another. It came in very handy then.
Do you have any gas mask training?
Yes.
What was that?
That was where you lined up outside this building, and they threw, I think it was CS, you'd go in, take your gas mask off. Oh no, you'd go in with your, that's it, you'd wait outside, they'd set a CS gas cylinder off. Then you'd walk in quickly, had a big heavy curtain, a door first and a big heavy curtain. And you went in, they got you in, it was dark, and you could see all mist. Then they tell you to take your gas masks off. You took your gas mask off, but they only kept you for about a minute. Then opened the door to let you out, and your eyes would be streaming, you'd be coughing and what name. But that was just to let you know how it felt. With a bit of CS gas. They had the mustard gas. Now, I can't remember, because what they did with mustard gas, because they obviously wouldn't put it on you because it would burn. And I can't now remember. I think what they did with us, they gave us something that was, the aroma was of mustard gas, so that if it ever was used, you would know, you would be able to tell. And all it was with a lot of it was smell, what it smelt like. But I think with the CS gas that they done was only to give you the feel. It just made your eyes stream and made you cough.
Do you have any education lessons, you know, to improve your education? Because you were only young. you know, education classes.
We had a little bit, yeah, but not a lot. In the, I was never very academic. Because I only had a council school education, but I got by and it taught myself a lot.
So they didn't put you through the class 1, 2, 3 or anything.
No, they that came later on when I joined the Royal Marines.